Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live from Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus. We've got a live show, as I said, and our guest today will be Noam Chomsky, the Institute Professor at MIT, universally accepted as one of the most preeminent intellectuals in the world alive today. In addition to his paradigm-breaking work in linguistics, Chomsky has been outspoken in his critique against U.S. foreign policy. He's lectured around the world on international affairs and human rights and written scores of books on media and politics, as well as on linguistics. He's probably best known in the realm of media for his work, Manufacturing Consent, which he co-authored with Ed Herman, who's been a guest on the show. More recently, he's written the book 9/11, which offers a penetrating analysis of the root causes of the September 11th terrorist attacks. Noam Chomsky, welcome to Media Matters. Hello, Noam. I guess we're working on our connection with Noam right now. Noam, are you there? Well, while we're working on our link to get Noam on the line, let me just let you know who we have in store for the next 2 weeks to join us here on Media Matters. On next Sunday, a week from today, our guest is going to be Peter Hart, who is the author of a new book, The O'Reilly Factor, published by Seven Stories Press. And The O'Reilly Factor just came out, and as you can imagine from the title, it is a critique of Bill O'Reilly and The O'Reilly Factor. Peter Hart works for the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, based out of New York City. And Peter will be joining us in 1 week to talk about the new book. 2 weeks from today, we're going to have as a guest here on Media Matters, a guest, someone we've had on the show probably more than anyone else in the history of the program. That's John Nichols. John is the Washington editor for The Nation magazine and a common contributor to The Nation on national politics and international politics. He's also the editorial page editor for the Cap Times in Madison, Wisconsin. And John will be here 2 weeks from today. Noam, you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Great. Wonderful to have you joining us today, Noam. Well, yeah, thanks for taking time off on your Sunday, too. It's really a treat for us. You're going to be coming to this area, if I'm not mistaken, on Tuesday.
That's right.
You'll be speaking in Bloomington Normal.
Yeah.
What are you going to be talking about?
Well, be talking about the plans of the fundamental plans of the current administration, their background, what the dilemmas are as they try to control the domestic population and control a complicated world, and what they're aiming to achieve, as I see it, and so on.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that today, if we can.
Okay. Sure.
Let's start with the world, and then we'll talk about the domestic population.
Mm-hmm.
As you see it, how do you look at the world today, and what do you see the U.S. government in particular, what's its plan for the world at this moment?
Well, they've been rather frank about it, so we don't have to speculate a lot. The National Security Strategy last September a year ago, announced very explicitly that the U.S. government, at least under its present leadership, intends to dominate the world permanently by force, which is the dimension in which it is supreme. By now, probably outspends the rest of the world combined in military spending, or close to that. Is building up the offensive military forces very quickly, including some pretty exotic ones. And it also intends to eliminate any potential challenge that it perceives to that domination. That's what they call preemptive war, but it has nothing to do with preemptive war. It's simply declaring the right to attack and destroy any force or coalition that is imagined or perceived to be a potential a challenger to U.S. domination. And that's caused tremendous concerns around the world. It led to a very sharp increase in fear and even loathing for the United States. It caused a lot of dissension within the foreign policy elite in the United States, who see it as an extremely dangerous position. It's not without precedent by any means. In fact, there are plenty of precedents for it, but it's at an extreme end. Furthermore, they made it very clear right away that they intended this to be taken seriously. It's not when you proclaim a doctrine, it doesn't mean very much unless you also make it clear that you intend to implement it. And as the doctrine was announced, they also began beating the war drums on the invasion of Iraq, which was going to illustrate the doctrine. It was going to establish what international lawyers will later call a new norm of international affairs, meaning the U.S. has the right to, nobody else, of course, has the right to use force to prevent any perceived potential challenge to its domination. And that was taken seriously. They informed the United Nations right away that their relevant was the word used, if and just in case they authorize the invasion, otherwise irrelevant, and they would be disregarded. The pretexts offered were not intended very seriously. They shifted all over the place, and anyone would do, depending on the occasion. That also frightened the world and led to an enormous, unprecedented negative reaction, which persists.
Noam Chomsky, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Noam, a lot of what you're describing from the U.S. perspective, or at least the perspective of the U.S. government, is done under the mantle of what's called a war on terrorism as the justification for an aggressive U.S. policy around the world. What's your take on the war on terrorism?
Well, first of all, it's worth bearing in mind a simple point that I never hear expressed, which is kind of astonishing. First of all, the people who declared the war on terror in September 2001 are, in fact, essentially the same people, very close to the same people, who declared a war on terror 20 years earlier. When the Reagan, these are mostly recycled from the Reagan Bush 1 administration, the more reactionary sectors of those administrations. And when they came to office in 1981, they declared a war on terror in pretty much the same rhetoric as today. Talk about, return to barbarism in the modern age, the dangerous threat to our security. The Congressional Declaration authorizing Washington to invade Iraq was almost the same words as the national emergency declared by Reagan in the early 80s, and when he declared that Nicaragua was an imminent threat to the security of the United States, declared a state of national emergency, renewed annually. That was the justification for the terrorist war against Nicaragua. We know what that war on terror turned into, namely a massive terrorist war, which devastated Central America and had horrifying effects elsewhere in the world. The people who were in charge of that war are in charge of this war. So that's a little background and precedent that's worth keeping in mind. That includes the Middle East, it includes their support for Saddam Hussein, and so on. Does this current, do the current activities have anything to do with the war on terror? Well, yeah, in a sense. I mean, it was predicted by intelligence agencies, including U.S. intelligence agencies and British intelligence, and by independent analysts. It was predicted, plausibly, that the invasion of Iraq would increase the threat of terror, and that it also would lead to increased proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. The reasons are pretty straightforward, and that's why it was so commonly predicted. That would be in part for revenge, but in part simply for deterrence. I mean, if potential victims don't just sit there and wait to be destroyed, they'll turn to whatever modes of deterrence they have available. And since nobody can confront the United States in conventional armaments, or even try, the weapons that they have available are terror, which is a deterrent, and weapons of mass destruction. So it was predicted that the war in Iraq would increase the threat of terror and probably increase proliferation, and it looks as if those predictions have been have been realized. Currently, the same intelligence agencies and independent analysts and specialists have pointed out that the war on the invasion of Iraq was the phrase that's being used is a huge setback in the war on terror. It's sharply increased recruitment for al-Qaeda-style organizations. It's in fact succeeded in turning Iraq itself into a center of terror, which was whatever, however horrible Saddam Hussein may have been, it was not a center of terrorism before. Now it is. So it's a setback in the war on terror, as was predicted.
No,
that's the relation.
No, what would you? What's your assessment of why the U.S. government's engaging in these, in the war in Iraq and in this so-called war on terrorism? What's the motivation behind the government acting this way?
I tend to agree with the conventional views on this, which again are widely expressed within elite circles and plausibly. First of all, the first is the one I mentioned. The national security strategy is intended seriously, and they want the world to understand that it's intended seriously. And the way you do that is through what are sometimes called exemplary actions. You announce a doctrine, and then you implement it. Well, they implemented a doctrine saying we're going to attack a country that we decide is a threat, even if there's no threat, and even if it increases the actual threats as it did. That's one. So why do it in Iraq? Why not in Eastern Congo or something? Well, the reason is Iraq, a number of reasons. One, the country that's targeted for attack has to meet several conditions. First of all, it has to be completely defenseless. That's important. You don't want to attack anyone who's going to get you into trouble. And Iraq was, of course, completely defensive. They knew perfectly well, just as its neighbors did, that it was the weakest country in the region, devastated by 10 years of murderous sanctions, another topic that we're not allowed to discuss, this half destroyed by earlier wars. So it was going to be defenseless. It was under complete surveillance. Whatever military forces it had been either eliminated mostly by disarmament or under constant bombardment. So that's condition one. Condition two is it has to be important. There are plenty of defenseless countries. But some country in Central Africa isn't important. Iraq is extremely important. For the U.S. to take over Iraq and end up with some sort of client government in there, maybe called a democracy, but doesn't mean much. It was reasonable to assume that the U.S. would end up with a client government, would end up with military bases right at the heart of the major oil-producing region of the world, reliable bases for the first time, and in effective control of the second-largest oil reserves in the world. That's extremely important. That's a major lever of world control that's been understood to be since the Second World War. And this would advance those policies enormously. And thirdly, there's a domestic aspect. It's worth remembering that the events of September 2002 included, first of all, the national security strategy, second, the virtual announcement they're going to invade Iraq, and the war, the hysteria about the Iraqi threat and its connections to al-Qaeda and so on. But thirdly, it was the opening of the midterm congressional campaign. Now, they want to stay in office. They barely hold political power. It's a very fragile hold. Karl Rove, the campaign manager for the Republicans, had already announced the summer before, had informed party activists that they cannot go into the campaign allowing social and economic issues to predominate, or else they'll be wiped out. Their policies are, for very good reasons, very unpopular. And therefore, they have to focus on national security issues. He's also made the same announcement, pretty much, about the presidential election. It's going to have to focus on national security, the so-called war on terror. And that succeeded. That's the problem. And for these people in office, it's second nature. That's the way they held on to power through the 1980s, constantly pressing the panic button. And it did succeed. If you look at exit polls, they did barely scrape through in the 2002 elections, small, just enough to hold on to political power for another 2 years. The People did not, exit polls and other studies show that people didn't change their preferences, but they did change their priorities. They shifted, they made security, the threat of an Iraqi attack and terror became the highest priority. Just as Congress went along with the essential reiteration of the Reagan Declaration of National Emergency. And that was just enough to scrape through. So there are three quite good reasons for going to war with Iraq.
We're talking to Noam Chomsky today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Noam, we've got a full bank of phone calls. So let's go to the phone lines right now.
Okay.
Line one, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Hello. Something I read a long time ago, it said that you lived on a kibbutz in Israel when you were young, I think with your family. And I was wondering if you could tell us why the modern state of Israel was created and whether it's lived up to its promise and whether, you know, you were disillusioned with it as a young person and what you think went wrong, if anything, and what hopes you have for the Israel-Palestine region.
Yeah, well, I wish we had an hour to talk about that. I hate to give a short answer, but just as briefly, and I hope this won't be too misleading, yes, 50 years ago, my wife and I, we were graduate students, so that's the family, just 50 years exactly, live in a kibbutz for a while. I did briefly. She went back and stayed for a longer time. And we did intend to, we were thinking seriously about going back and staying, and we might have, you know, various accidents of life led in a different direction. I had grown up with this. I had grown up, as had my wife, within what in those days was called the Zionist movement. Today it would be called, the same positions would be called anti-Zionist. Up until I was a Zionist youth activist, but that, and part of the movement that was opposed to a Jewish state, which was part of the Zionist movement at the time, up till 1948, because of the belief that a Jewish state could not possibly be a democratic state, and that the hopes for an egalitarian, cooperative society based on these quasi-anarchist and collectivist structures really had some possibilities, and it was a period of a lot of that also committed to Arab-Jewish cooperation and so on. All right, that came to an end in 1948. The state was established, and those issues were moot. We almost went anyway, hoping, you know, because of lots of things that attracted us about the country and about the kibbutzim itself. And so it continues up until about 1967. In fact, before the 1967 war, there was a notable decline in sort of jingoist sentiment. The 67 war changed all that. It was a war of conquest. They conquered the occupied territories, what are now the occupied territories, and it made a huge change in the nature of the country, an even bigger change here in the United States. At that point, I have a book that just came out about this called Middle East Delusions, if you're interested, which includes a book of essays that appeared about 30 years ago. My own feeling from 1967 for several years was that they had a very good opportunity to move towards some kind of federal structure in Cisjordan, Mandatory Jordan, Palestine, the area from the Jordan River to the sea, Israel and the occupied territories, a federated binational system, which over time, with one could hope, would move towards closer integration as people established relations on non-national lines. There are plenty of such relations, of course. By 1973, that opportunity was lost, the only option from that point on was what was an international consensus that developed right in the mid-70s, very broad international consensus, including the Arab states, the PLO, the Europe, Eastern Europe, just about everyone, for a two-state settlement. on the international border with maybe some minor adjustments. That's the pre-June 67 border. That was blocked. Israel opposed it. The United States decided to back Israel. And since the mid-70s, the United States has unilaterally prevented the implementation of the international consensus on a two-state settlement. And that continues up to the present moment, right through the Clinton years and right until today. Well, that led to a period of Israel made a fateful decision, namely it could have had peace, it knew it, and integration into the region, but it chose expansion instead, not for reasons of security. That was not even a barely not even a pretext, just reasons of expansion. And the U.S. backed them. I think it was a terrible mistake. It has led to suffering and destruction of deterioration of the internal nature in both societies. They're now locked in a kind of a cycle of almost tribal warfare, descending into hell for both of them. It's a familiar cycle. And it was based on those decisions and the continuation until today of the unwillingness to accept the political settlement that has been available. Well, interestingly, by now, certain number of people on both sides, among Israel and the Palestinians, are beginning to feel that the settlement programs, the development and settlement programs that Israel's been carrying out and that the U.S. has been backing, have taken over so much of the occupied territories. And the percentages don't mean much. You have to look at where they are. They break it up into essentially cantons that entrap the population in, almost in jails. It's gone so far, they feel, and they may be right, that the two-state settlement is no longer realistic. And now there is talk again about what was in fact possible in the early 70s, but nobody would, just no support for it, I was very sorry to see, namely move towards some sort of a federated system of one state. I think I've always thought since childhood that would be a much better solution all along. And it is conceivable that that could be implemented today, but it'll require either that or a two-state settlement on the international border with some adjustments would require a very sharp change in U.S. Attitudes. And that's, I think...
Noam, what was the incentive of the United States? What was the reason why it, in the 60s and early 70s, elected to push or support an aggressive Israeli policy and not sort of push it from the other side?
Yeah. Well, we're talking about a period where we do not have a record, a real record of declassified documents, so there's a certain amount of speculation involved. But we know what happened. What happened is that in 1967, Israel won a smashing victory. It destroyed major enemies of the United States. Egypt under Nasser was considered a serious enemy. He was part of a major pillar of the non-aligned movement. You may remember Sukarno in Indonesia was destroyed by a murderous military coup just about at the same time, also with the backing of the U.S., another pillar of the non-aligned movement. Nasserite Egypt was regarded as, was in fact, the center of independent Arab nationalism, which the U.S. strongly opposed. It was considered a threat to the oil-producing monarchies that are effectively U.S. clients that run the, that manage the oil system for the benefit primarily of the United States and its allies. So that threat was eliminated by Israeli force. Well, okay, they won a lot of points for that. And it continued. They were by far the major military force in the region. It was assumed at the time that there's no challenge to their military power. In 1971, Egypt offered a full peace settlement to Israel, full peace settlement. Nothing for the Palestinians, incidentally, just full peace in return for Israeli withdrawal from Egyptian territory. Well, it was discussed internally in Israel. They knew that that would mean peace. Egypt was the major military, what there was of a military force on the Arab side. But they chose to reject it and in favor of expansion. At that point, expansion into the Sinai was the main issue, Egyptian territory. The U.S. had a choice. It decided the choice was basically the split. Kissinger, who was National Security Advisor, was in favor of what he called stalemate. That is, no negotiations. Let's just keep it the way it is, rejecting the Egyptian offer. And in the internal bureaucratic battle, he won out. The United States decided to support Israeli expansion and aggression, and essentially began at that point to turn Israel into what amounts to a U.S. military base, offshore military base, a high-tech industry closely tied to U.S. industry, highly militarized, and so on. The process began then. In 1973, to everyone's astonishment, Egypt had said it was going to go to war unless Israel withdrew from Egyptian territory, and nobody believed them, but they did. Kissinger, at that point, realized he'd made a terrible mistake. It was a very dangerous war. It led to a nuclear alert. It was extremely dangerous for Israel. At that point, U.S. policy shifted towards a kind of diplomatic settlement, which would leave Israel in effective control over the territories, but after making peace with Egypt, that is, agreeing to Egypt's terms for peace with Egypt. And that's been pretty much the policy since. Meanwhile, Israel is far and away the most powerful military force in the region. In fact, its own military analysts claim, maybe rightly, that even it has more powerful air and armored forces than any NATO power, let alone Middle Eastern powers, meaning outside the U.S. Small country, but as an offshoot of the United States, it becomes a powerful country and highly militarized and closely integrated with comparable parts of the U.S. militarized economy.
We're talking to Noam Chomsky today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. The phone line's here if you have a question or comment for Professor...
Let me just add one sentence.
Sure, go right ahead.
Yeah. The way in which the major interest of the U.S. has never been Israel and still isn't. It's the oil-producing regions. But a concept was developed during those years was expressed by the Nixon administration as having local cops on the beat, is the way they put it, non-Arab states, which would be local gendarmes, police headquarters in Washington, in case there's trouble, and they would just protect the Arab monarchies from any independent nationalism, the Shah of Iran at the time, Israel, Turkey, all the way back to the 1950s. Now, that's the framework for controlling the oil-producing regions.
Okay, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, and that line is open, is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines here. Some people have been very patient. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Professor Chomsky, first of all, I'd like to thank you for being Noam Chomsky, the person who brings so much truth and enlightenment into the public domain. The question I have is whether you have any information or insight as to whether the restoration of the flow of the production of poppies and heroin in Afghanistan has played any role in the United States policy and current incursions into Afghanistan, and perhaps why we haven't heard through all of the forays of the U.S. military in Afghanistan any revelations of the finding of caches of poppies or cocaine, heroin.
Well, the basic facts are not in doubt. Afghanistan had become a major producer of opium and heroin, one of the major producers. The Taliban in the last couple of years had banned it. There's debate about exactly why, but the production had definitely cut back very sharply. It's since the U.S. took over, it's been rising again very fast. It's now probably back to where it was or even beyond. That's just the facts. As to your question, that's one of the connections. Does it have to do with U.S. plans? I doubt it very much. I think the U.S. would be happy if Afghan farmers would produce something else other than growing poppy. But they are in a situation where there's nothing much else they can do. It's kind of like people driven off into the countryside in Colombia as the as a part of the marginalization and the destruction of a good part of the peasantry. They're driven off into marginal areas. They just have no other way to survive. Alternative development programs would work, but that requires putting in funds, it requires reconstruction efforts, it requires a serious attempt to rebuild the society. And, you know, the U.S. is just not willing to consider that. So there is the effect is, yes, there's a very significant return to large-scale opium production, apparently quite enormous by this point. Incidentally, there is a connection going way back to the Second World War between so-called clandestine military activities, you know, CIA, other sorts of subversion and intervention on the one hand, and production of drugs on the other. Well, that's been very well studied. Al McCoy did the basic studies on that, a very important work 30 years ago, since extended, and others have joined in too. And Afghanistan fits very well into that pattern. Doesn't mean that the U.S. has been trying to increase drug production. It's just a kind of an automatic consequence of the kinds of activities that it is carrying out in subversion and intervention. It's just one of the consequences of that means turning for support to sort of mafia-like elements who are going to extend their wealth and power in the obvious ways, drugs being one of them.
Noam Chomsky, let's go back to the phone lines. We have a full bank of callers, and I want to get to them. So right now, let's go to line 3, Champaign County. You're on the air with Noam Chomsky. Hello?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm line 3, are you there? I think we might have lost that caller, unfortunately.
Hello? Hello,
yes, you're on.
I'm very sorry. I guess this remote phone is letting me down here.
Okay, you're on the air.
Sorry to waste the time. And I'm torn between two questions, which is ask Professor Chomsky to go on about the Middle East in the light of this attack into 8 miles from Damascus last night that a so-called supporter of Israel like Krautheimer this morning on NBC chat show said was they're perfectly entitled to do, but it just is strategically very strange. He doesn't understand what they're doing. But what actually motivated me to call was to talk about the kind of strategies that are available for resistance right now in the sense of what do you think of the mass gatherings at FTAA in Miami that's being planned even today at 2 o'clock at the Independent Media Center in Urbana? To going to those kind of things, I think it's still extremely important, despite the fact that it looks to me that the Bush administration is less into that kind of multilateral thing. They'd prefer to unilaterally make bilateral plans and agreements with other countries. But it still seems like it's a reasonable venue for discourse and at least trying to voice some kind of resistance to the corporate structure. And even though it's extremely lampoonable and ignored by news media and actually lampooned by the entertainment media and shows like Threat Matrix, where they make snide comments about G8 demonstrators just a couple of weeks ago, just watching around, I guess, and looking at what kind of things are actually forming the opinions in this country, it seems. Anyway, thanks for letting me go on so long and having such a rambling question, but either of those two points would be great, and hope to see you on Tuesday.
Yes, and resistance.
I didn't quite catch the first point, so let me stick to the second, okay?
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the U.S. government is very much committed to something like the FTAA and the World Trade Organization proposals, the IMF system, and so on. And it's certainly not true that resistance has had no effect. It's had an enormous effect in many cases. It's been going on for years. I mean, the multilateral agreement on investments, which they tried to ram through in secret about 5 years ago, was undermined by unexpected popular resistance around the world, which had to develop outside the media. The media wouldn't touch it. They wouldn't mention it. But global resistance did develop. This is before Seattle. It developed through local organizing, internet contacts, and so on. And it was powerful enough to compel the richest countries in the world, the OECD, to back off from that secret plan. They're trying to introduce it in other ways, but that proposal was killed just a couple of weeks ago at Cancun for complicated reasons. But the meetings broke down, the World Trade Organization meetings. But one factor was a kind of a de facto alliance, sort of tacit alliance between large-scale popular resistance, including demonstrations and other actions, in opposition to the plans that they were trying to ram through, and opposition by a number of the so-called developing countries, Brazil and others, who just wouldn't go along with the plans. And that was an interaction. So it's continued. I mean, you don't expect the media to applaud popular actions that are undermining policies that they want to ram through and that are in the interests that they represent, primarily corporate interests. Of course, they're not going to applaud it. But that doesn't mean that the actions lack effectiveness. In fact, they have great effectiveness. The global justice movements that have developed in the last couple of years are quite astounding. There's never been anything like them in history. And yeah. They're causing a lot of nervousness in power centers.
Yeah, no, but to follow up on that, I mean, you've been an activist for five decades, more or less. You've been in the United States and in the world, obviously. Where do you sense popular politics are, specifically in the United States today, in sort of a historical sense? I mean, how do our current times fare in comparison to the 50s, 60s, 70s? And are you an optimist at this point? How do you feel?
Well, let's just take that period. I mean, the 50s were a period of... the 30s was a period of extreme activism, and it made major changes in the country. It was the popular activism and the labor movement and other movements that led to the New Deal programs and the progressive legislation that the current administration and the Reaganites, in fact, have been trying to unravel ever since. And it really struck fear into the hearts of the centers of the business community. They were deeply concerned about what they called the hazard-facing industrialists and the rising political power of the masses. Well, the World War sort of put it on hold. After the war came a major struggle, including huge propaganda efforts to try to roll back this activism. The Cold War was effectively used for that purpose. The 1950s were a period of what looked like quiescence. In fact, it was a period in which elites were hailing what they called the end of ideology, similar to what's now called the end of history. We've won. It's all in our hands. From now on, it's just a matter of rich and powerful people tinkering to make sure things work, and the mass of the population is busy doing something else. Okay, then the 60s came along, and all of that fell apart. There was substantial activism, and it had an enormous effect. It's changed not only what happened in the 60s, but the aftermath, particularly the 70s and the 80s, have changed the country enormously in all sorts of respects. On the other hand, it did naturally lead to a counter-reaction, an effort to beat back what was called the crisis of democracy, too much democracy. That's when the major right-wing think tanks came along trying to take over the ideological spectrum and drive it far to the right. The neoliberal economic programs can actually fit in here very, very naturally. They're primarily intended to undermine democratic opportunities, and they do that. Meanwhile, the popular movements just continued to develop, but in a style which is characteristic of the United States. Very little central organization. They don't center as in other countries around the labor movement or farmers' movements and so on, because these movements, the United States just happens to have developed for various reasons in such a way that these movements are rather marginal and depoliticized. There are no political parties. There's nothing like a labor party. so they don't coalesce around labor parties, parliamentary parties. On the other hand, they're very broad and very large, wide participation. In the 1980s, for example, the solidarity movements that developed, primarily Central American solidarity at the time, rooted right in the mainstream of American society. It was more on Main Street than it was in elite centers. They were something completely new in the history of imperialism. There's never been a time when European or U.S. imperialism, when people from the imperial country literally went to live with the victims, to help them, to offer them some protection and so on. And this was done on a substantial scale, affected the domestic society here too. It's now extended all of, in many ways around the world. And out of this came the U.S. participation in the global justice movements, which primarily developed in the South in countries like Brazil and India, but with the richer countries beginning to participate later on, and in the United States coming out of roots like these. It's now very extensive, but hard to measure. It's very diffuse, very disorganized. That has its strengths and its weaknesses. The weaknesses are that you don't have continual learning experiences. You don't learn from what happened last time and let's do it better next time, because there's very little sense of continuity and awareness of it. On the other hand, the strength is it's not so easy to disrupt. It's coming up all over the place.
No, we've only got about 10 minutes left, and I've got four callers who are very patient, so I think I'm going to have to go back to the phone lines and try to let everyone have an opportunity to ask their question. Line one, you're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Yeah, thank you. Noam sounds strong and healthy. I hope that means we're going to hear from him for a long time to come. But I have a question about Latin America. I've read about cooperative movements in Argentina, but on the other hand, there seems to be increasing American resources being dumped into Colombia. So I was just curious if you had an overview of what the prospects might be in Latin America for true self-determination down there. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Well, the fact of the matter is that U.S. military resources, training, troops, military aid, and so on, in Latin America may well be at an all-time high. They're certainly very high. Colombia is the main recipient of U.S. military aid and training. That's been true for a long time, and it's very substantial now. There are also troops there. There are private corporations, basically military corporations under a private guise like DynCorp there. In Colombia, it's a matter of trying. It's basically counterinsurgency. There's a huge mass of the peasant population has been basically driven off the land. This is indigenous people, Afro-Colombians, campesinos, been driven off the land, driven to marginal areas. It's a potentially very rich society, but extremely divided, enormous amounts of poverty, huge urban slums, which led to resistance. And the reaction has been tremendous violence, which the U.S. is supporting through support for the military and indirectly paramilitaries. By now, it's turned the guerrillas into another terrorist army, pretty much. They've pretty much lost the social programs they had a couple of years ago as largely a result of the militarization of the conflict. The peasants are right in the middle. I mean, actually, I was down there about a year ago, and they're being devastated by what amounts to chemical warfare. We call it fumigation. Atrocities on all sides, driven off the lands, so that mining companies, international investors can come in to take over the resources, which are rich, oil, coal mines, many others, agribusiness as well. That's Colombia. On the other hand, Argentina, it's quite a different story. The Argentina religiously followed the IMF Treasury rules, and it led to a total disaster. The economy just collapsed after being hailed as the poster boy for neoliberal development. And one reaction was what you described. I mean, the spontaneous organ growth of a counter-economy, which is quite complex, a lot of popular participation, having a fair amount of success. Brazil, which is the most important country in the region by far, has just had a spectacular achievement of democracy, which I can't think really of any counterpart. Mass popular movements succeeded in electing, they're taking over the political system, electing their own president, who happens to be a marvelous person. This is the labor movement, the landless workers movement, which is huge, other popular movements. And they succeeded in doing it, even though Brazil has one of the most unequal distributions of wealth in the world. They were facing enormous concentration of capital, total media opposition. But they managed to do it through organizing and activism that was able to counter that concentration. Now, how much they're now kind of trapped. The neoliberal mechanisms of the past 20 years, 20, 30 years, have been pretty well designed to reduce the opportunity for a democratic choice. The countries are very much constrained by international investors. That's part of what these mechanisms are about. And it's possible that they may not be able to implement the programs that that the great majority of the population did support, which is a real struggle going on, hard to predict.
Yeah, what happens then?
It's very, very, either something, it could go either way. It could go towards a much more radical change, which would, in the whole region, lead to breaking out of the neoliberal framework, canceling debts, cutting back capital flight, using resources for internal investment. That would bring on them the wrath of the United States and its allies, which can be pretty brutal. But it's one possibility. The other possibility is to succumb, in which case it might have a devastating effect on the enormous growth of the left and the popular movements in the region. I don't think that's predictable, really. Actually, a lot depends on how people here react to it. If they do move toward in an independent direction, it would require very real solidarity in places like the United States to prevent a brutal counter-reaction of the kind that's taken place in the past, and this is on a much larger scale than anything in the past. I mean, the whole Andean region is in turmoil, from Bolivia up through Venezuela. Countries are out of control of the United States. There's a lot of lots of tendencies developing, which the U.S. is strongly opposed to. Popular tendencies, populist in various ways, many of them fairly radical. That's why there's such a concentration of military force developing there. And if the United States succeeds in controlling Iraq without too great a cost, and does go on to implement this free aggression policy, what they call preemptive war policy, freely, the Andean region is not an unlikely target.
Well, let's go back to our phone lines if we can. We've got three callers who've been very patient. We have very little time. Line four, Eureka, you're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Just a short two-part question. Would your take on the Iraq war be it's about oil or more than that, and your comments about the media coverage of it? It's an honor to speak with you, sir.
All right, Noam?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that oil is a major reason. That's why it's Iraq and not some other country. But it's not the only reason, I won't repeat, but I think there were other motives for it as well. But oil, sure, it's enormous. As for the media, well, there isn't much time, but what I'd suggest you do if you have a few minutes free and have Internet access is have a look at a study that just came out, was just released a couple of days ago, by the Program on International Policy Attitudes, PIPA. You can find it on the web.
Yeah, at the University of Maryland?
Yeah, it's the major, the most serious and important polling organization in the country, maybe the world. And they just released an extremely interesting study. It's the latest in the series on media in Iraq. What they found is very unbelievably high. Well, you know, not, maybe that's not unbelievable, but remarkable levels of misperception on the Iraq war, in connection with alleged Iraqi alliances with Al Qaeda, involvement in 9/11, total serious misinterpretation of the worldwide reaction to the war. And more strikingly, these misinterpretations, misperceptions, as they call them, are very highly correlated with support for the war. So, and that's not too surprising. So people who thought that, who did believe that Iraq is a major threat to our security, that it's tied up with 9/11, that it's working with terror, that it's, that the world supports us on it, they were more likely to support the war by a very high measure. Then they break this down into the sources of information that people used. Well, most people, it's television and radio. And the more it turns out, the more the highest misperceptions by far are the Fox system. Then come the regular channels, which are very high. In fact, even the lowest was NPR, PBS, and even that there, the misperceptions were high. And furthermore, it turns out that it's not a matter of not paying attention. Now, the people who were paying more attention to the news were, in fact, often the highest in misperceptions. Well, you know, that leads to some conclusions about what was being transmitted to them. But it is a striking fact, even before this study, that as the government media propaganda campaign began to build up in September 2002, attitudes revealed in polls began to change sharply towards beliefs about the Iraqi threat, its tie-up with terror, and so on. It was very noticeable, and that did lead to gaining, you know, roughly half the population willing to support the war.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you, Noam Chomsky, for being our guest today in Media Matters. Noam Chomsky will be speaking Tuesday, in 2 days, October 7th at 7 p.m. in the Bradom Auditorium in the Bone Student Center at Illinois State University in Normal. I urge you all to attend if you have an opportunity. Noam, again, thank you for joining us, and I look forward to seeing you on Tuesday.
Yep, look forward to it.
Yep, and 1 week from today, we'll have Peter Hart joining us, talking about the O'Reilly Factor on the Fox Network, which Noam just referred to. I'd like to thank Brett, the engineer, and my two producers. I had a tag team today, Andrew Boyle and Victor Picard, for helping us with the show. See you all in 167 hours. Thank you.